Hey, what it do, sports fans? Welcome to the Sports Live podcast brought to you by Multimedia Live. I'm Sboom Jikeliso, your host, and I will be joined by various guests on this exciting new podcast to discuss the latest ins and outs of the sporting world. Hello and welcome to yet another episode of the Sports Live podcast. Yeah, that's right. This award-winning podcast is back and you would have heard us last week. And we were talking about the legacy of EL10s, East London 10s, of course, that happened in December. Guys like Skaran Tubeni as well as Sikhumbuzo Noche featured on this podcast. They were part of the organizers for that event, which was amazing. I was there, of course, East London being my hometown. I could not miss out. I had a chat with those two guys. And if you missed that conversation, you need to go back and listen to it because there are nuggets, there are gems, so many wonderful things that those guys are doing that I feel ought to be, you know, enunciated, man. They also speak about, you know, their careers as well, how far they've gone. I mean, Sikhumbuzo Noche is from a place called Qoboqobo, which is known as Kaiska Mahook, which their previous Springbok was a guy called Jongi Nokwe. It's a place right outside of King Williamstown where you wouldn't really expect to find the best rugby players. Pretty similar to where Makazole Mapimpi is from, which is Jolomnga, you know, very rural, very underdeveloped area, but they love their rugby there. I'd even spoken to a guy like Faj Mabetta last year, and he said he ended up in a Qoboqobo one time, and they were playing a game of touch rugby, and he thought, okay, I'm a pro. Let me join them, you know. I'm going to chuck the ball around with these guys and see how it goes. He says they ran him ragged. He pulled a hamstring 15 minutes in, and he was like, okay, guys, now I've had enough. So that kind of shows you how passionate those guys are about their rugby. And in the last episode, we spoke to one of the guys from there, of course, Sikhumbuzo Noche, as well as Skaran Tubeni, about the legacy of East London 10s and what it means to people of the Eastern Cape region. And this week, though, we've deviated a little further than what you're used to, a little further from the main sports. This week, we have Kirsten Landman. She is a hard enduro rally rider, and we have entered into the realm of motorsport this week. She is currently in the throngs of the Dakar Rally, where she is one of only two African women to enter this race. And now this is where things get a little interesting, is the second woman who was also on the starting grid at the Dakar Rally to be in the history books as one of the first women, African women, to ride the Dakar Rally is Tay Perry, who also happens to be from East London. Yeah, that's right. She is from East London. She is a two-time former national off-road women's title winner. Five times Gauteng cross country club champion between 2010 and 2012 and between 2014 and 2015. And she's done a whole lot. She's done the Toyota Desert 1000 race and finished third overall. I think Kirsten Landman has won the Desert 1000 a couple of times, if I'm not mistaken. But we're going to get into that conversation. So here we are, second podcast of 2020. And we have delved into sports that are largely untouched and largely unfavored. And we're really putting the kind of content that we feel you guys ought to come here and you'll know what you're going to get. You're going to get stuff that's not usually reported on, and you're going to get rich conversations. And that's what we're about. So my conversation with Kirsten Landman's full 30 minute long, and she talks about her amazing journey where she had an accident in 2013 while she was in Botswana doing a race in Botswana, which I wrote about on New Frame. And thank you again to the guys of New Frame, who are absolutely amazing, who put out great stuff. And in her attempts to ride in Botswana, this was in 2013, Kirsten Landman got into a very, very severe accident whereby she had a lacerated spleen, a severed pancreas, and a ripped small intestine. This was during a double groove in an S-bend during the second day of the Botswana 1000 Desert Race. And it sent her enduro motorbike into a tree stump. And, you know, she didn't have any outward visible injuries. Instead, they were all internal. So they didn't think she was hurt that badly. In fact, it took her 36 hours for her to get proper medical treatment. And really, she was at death's door. She was in a world of pain. She didn't know what was wrong with her. The doctors in Botswana As we get into this conversation, you'll find out that they weren't really equipped to deal with those injuries. And she had to be airlifted from Botswana to South Africa, where she finally, 36 or 39 hours later, she got the medical attention that she needed. And the doctor flat out told her that, you know, she's very lucky to be alive. He actually didn't know how in the world she still managed to be alive with a ruptured small intestine. And I describe in the story I did for New Frame as the Amelia Earhart of hard enduro racing, because for me, she is a pioneer. Not only that, her recovery story, man, is one that should be told over and over again. She'll probably venture into the motivational speaking realm once she's done with her hard enduro racing. But for now, she's experiencing what it's like to tough it out in the Dakar Rally, and she's doing well. From what I'm told, I'm following her updates on social media. I suggest you do the same. So in the 42-year history of the race, we South Africans are proud to say that we brought the first two African women to the Dakar, Tay Perry as well as Kirsten Landman. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this conversation I had with Kirsten Landman. Thank you again to the guys that made sure I had the interview on lock, Mike Sharman, as well as Ben Karpinski of Retro Viral and Retro Active. But I'll leave it at that and do enjoy this conversation. If you take anything out of it, it's a story of endurance. Yeah, excuse the pun. All right, this is Kirsten Landman. And welcome to the Sports Live podcast. And I think this is probably the most diverse we've gotten in terms of sports in the podcast, which is pretty new. It's only about 6 months old, but it is a pleasure to have you on and welcome.
Thank you for having me.
As we're speaking, as we're recording this, you are preparing for the Dakar Rally. Obviously, by the time this comes out, you will obviously be in Saudi Arabia. Are you looking forward to that?
Yeah, I'm super excited. It's been a long journey, and I can't believe that we're a month away from it. And yeah, super, super, super exciting. 2 years of hard work and preparation, and it all comes down to the last month and 2 weeks of racing in Saudi.
How do you prepare for any motorsport event? Do you like have to eat a certain way, drink loads of water?
Yeah, so riding motorbikes is, most people initially think that the motorbike does all the work, but yeah, it's the complete opposite. You must remember, we ride in a motorbike that weighs, so my enduro bike will weigh 120 kilos and then my Dakar bike weighs 180 kilos. So you maneuvering that
and
thing.
You weigh?
And I weigh now 73. So it's been a huge adjustment preparing for Dakar, but I've been on my motorbike my whole life. I've been riding since I was 8, so for me it's as easy as walking.
Yeah.
But this whole adjustment in prepping for Dakar has been very different for the last 2 years in terms of prepping for it, because it is a motorbike, but it's very different to what I'm used to, you know. So the weight distribution, the power of the motorbike, and yeah, of course prepping for a race like Dakar. I mean, I've never ridden on a motorbike for 12 days in a row. I've never covered 8,000 Ks in 12 days, and I've never done the Dakar. So I don't know what to expect, but from my experiences gained in racing hard enduro and stuff, I'm hoping that I'm going to be prepared. I've done the best that I can do to prepare.
Yeah.
So it we'll hopefully it'll all go according to plan.
Are you part of the KTM team, right?
Yeah, so I ride for the Brother Leader Tread KTM South Africa team.
Yeah.
So it's like a South Africa's factory team here. Mm-hmm. And so I've been on the team for 7 years already, so I'm a vet on the team.
Yeah.
And yeah, they've been super supportive in my career in terms of the enduros, extreme enduros, and racing around the world. And it's all been a part of the process into making this decision and getting to Dakar.
Do you have a coach, mentor that gets you through your regimen just to prepare yourself for what you're going to face in Saudi Arabia?
So I've got a coach who coaches me on the motorbike. His name is William Gillett. I've been working with him for years. I've been riding with Will since I was 15.
Shout out to Will.
Yeah, Will's a good oak. He's a real character.
Yeah.
And he's taught me most things that I know. And he's brought up a lot of the top South African riders that are in the best in the world now. So he's really good. You know, I've got a lot of guys that I've looked up to and mentors that I've had coach me and train me, guys like Daryl Curtis, Joey Evans, and then I've got a lady who's completely separate to the riding community, has been working on mind work with me. So, you know, I've got a lot of people from all aspects,
yeah,
coming in and helping out, because there's a lot that goes into it, you know, being a professional sports person in general.
Yeah. I was about to get into that mind conversation. I like the mental aspect of sports, you know, and what's your mental preparation like? And I know specifically for you, Rubia, quite a focus, I would think, especially after the accident you had in 2013, was it?
That's right.
In Botswana. So right now, do you focus a lot on getting your mind sharp and getting over some anxieties and that kind of stuff?
So initially when I came about to making this decision, it was beginning of 2017 when the idea was sparked. And I pondered on the thought myself for a year, where I didn't really voice it out loud to anyone until the end of 2017 because of the fears that I had faced from my accident in 2013. Yeah. I mean, Dakar is a high-speed race and many people die. I mean, the rally's been going for 42, 41 years and I think there's been nearly 70-something deaths. So the death rate is high. And nearly. So it is quite scary. And And again, it's a high-speed race, and I swore after my accident never to do high-speed racing again. So as part of this, I was like, I've got to face my fears head-on, and no better way to do it than doing the Dakar Rally. So that, for me, was a big thing to overcome myself. But then when I made the decision, I was like, I can't do this by myself. And I met a lady that lives down in Natal. Her name's Jeanette Thorpe, and she's been an intricate part of everything I've done. I mean, she, apart from, well, as well as working with me on the bike and you know, overcoming difficulties that I face on the bike, as much as being fit is such a huge part of it, but knowing to when you get to that point where you think that you've hit a wall, you got to carry on because you've still got 3, 4, 5, 6 more walls that you're going to hit that you can still get through. I mean, I've been put into the deepest, darkest places where I just wanted to die, crawl under my bike and die and not wake up, because it's such a physically demanding sport, and so much so that it'll push you to the point where you're vomiting and you're crying and you're hating life, but you know, you just got to carry on, and the only way you can get out there is by getting on your motorbike and carry on riding. So I mean, I've faced a lot of those challenges in all the races that I've done, and I'm so glad I've been through that, because I can tell you now I'm going to face that in Dakar. And once you get into that that deep dark place, to not go deeper into that dark place, to come out of it and try to see the positives and to kind of like look back to see how far you've come to go further. Yeah. So, because that's probably been the biggest thing for me, you know. I mean, I've had so many doubts all the time. Can I do this? I mean, I'm human. We all go through those things. So, having a lot of the country backing me and supporting me has also been a good thing, you know. And then again, it crosses my mind all the time. You know, we spent 2 years prepping for this. A lot of time and money has gone into it. And I sometimes wake up and I'm like, oh my gosh, what happens if I don't finish?
A lot of responsibility as well. Like when you get that wave of support, you kind of feel like you don't want to let people
down.
That's
exactly it.
Yeah, as well. I mean, it must be one hell of a feat to be able to get yourself up for it every single day. What are some of the sort of mental milestones you'll say, okay, I've done this, or maybe on the bike, you'll be able to say, I used to be afraid to go at certain speeds.
Yeah.
Now I'm able to cross that barrier. What are just some of the small little milestones you've gone through and said, okay, now I'm able to do this, I'm able to do that. It means it's a sign that I'm getting back to my confidence, my speed confidence, or I'm getting over that fear overtaking, that sort of thing. Yeah.
So initially when I got this idea to do Dakar, I doubted myself because I had never really raced a rally.
Yeah.
And I went to the Mazuga rally, which was my qualifying rally in April this year, and I started to train off the roadbook. So a roadbook is like it's our route on a paper scroll that sits on the mount, on the navigation mount on the front of the motorbike, and you literally, it's on a piece of paper. It's old school. It's the legend of Dakar, which makes it so cool, and everyone rides off one of those things. So you get your kilometer reading, you get your directional reading, and then you get an information reading, which is marked in French. So you have to learn a little bit of, learn the translations of what it means. And while you're right, I mean, I can't speak a word, but I've learned to translate the French into the exact English.
Yeah.
So when you're riding, you're scrolling the whole time at each kilometer. So when I started to learn about the roadbook, I realized that riding off a roadbook is actually so safe, depending on the guy who marked the roadbook, because you know at exactly what kilometer what is coming up. So they mark off danger markings. They mark off a dip in the road. They'll mark off rocks in the road. I mean, these oaks are spending a year putting together. I mean, imagine doing a road book of 8,000 kilometers. It's massive. And also, they've also got to take into consideration that the guys are going to be riding down a straight at 180 kilometers an hour. So they mark them really, really well. And when I started riding off the road book, it kind of put my mind at ease, because racing nationally around South Africa and also around the world, we ride off just normal GPSs, Garmin little e-trex GPSs, which is literally you're a dot on an arrow and you follow an arrow. There's no form of information on that little GPS, whereas a road book, you've got all the information of what's in front of you, where you're turning, what kilometer you're at. So when I started doing that, it made me really realize that, listen, okay, you can only navigate as fast as you go, but also if you're not following your road book and watching it carefully, that's how the accidents do happen.
Right, so you have to pay attention.
You're paying attention to your, exactly. Yeah. So, and that's why what I like, that's what I love most about rallying, and I think it's a very expensive little hobby that I've fallen in love with, because it is, it's like, if I can explain to you, it's like playing a PlayStation game, and you are collecting little tokens along the way
as you go,
and if you are on the correct road book, which we will be, you pick up these little things called waypoints. They're hidden waypoints, and if you're navigation smart, you'll pick up all your little waypoints, and when your little system beeps because you've picked up your waypoint, you're like, yes, and then you go on to the next one. At the end of the day, if you've collected all your waypoints, and if you've missed some, every single waypoint that you miss, you get a time penalty. So going back to one of the milestones that I was worried about, you know, the high speed of Dakar and the danger of Dakar, is the fact that a lot of it has got a lot better because I love the road book, I love riding off of it, and because it's so informative. So that was when I started riding off the road book. I mean, I had only ever watched Dakar, and I never really had experienced what it was like to ride a Dakar motorbike and ride off navigation. And when I started to ride off the navigation, I realized, okay, this, if you're good at your navigation, you watch your road book, and you know, you ride smart, you know, you can avoid the accidents, because the moment most guys have all the accidents is when they're following someone in front of them, they're not following their road book, and they don't see the dip in the road because they're not watching the road book, and that's when they have the accident, or they get hit by another car or another bike or another something coming up. But, and again, my goal is to go there to finish and, you know, ride a smart race and hit all the waypoints and just finish. So that's my goal. And I do believe that my navigation is really good. So I think if navigation's good, I'll have a good race.
How happy are you to just be alive?
Oh, stoked. You have no idea. You know, everyone says that saying, you don't know what you got until it's gone. And I nearly had my life taken away from me. And I was blessed enough to get a second chance on life. And after that accident, once I woke up and came to my senses, I swore never to take life for granted, to live each day like it's my last. And that's what I have done. I mean, every opportunity I've been given, and every opportunity I haven't been given, I've made sure I've worked towards it so that I've got made sure that opportunity came about.
Yeah,
I mean, like Dakar, most people only ever dream of doing it, but we've worked hard, put it together, and of course there's a lot of people that come with it, but it was a goal, it was just an idea, and here we are, we're just waiting before the race to start. So I don't take anything for granted. I love spending the time with my family. I love spending time with my dogs. I love spending time with my friends, and I do everything to the fullest.
And do you ever get like dreams and like flashbacks to that accident in Botswana?
A lot of the time, and especially now, you know, I'm kind of, my mom says I'm like an ostrich. I put my head in the ground and I let the world carry on going behind me, and that's what I did with the accident. And since, you know, this whole story's come up with Ryobi and working with the media guys wanting to know more about the story, I've had to live it a lot more, and now, even since we've been talking about it, I've started to remember a lot more of this stuff, just because it's not that I forgot it, I just didn't think about it. I put it behind me, so I'm starting to remember a hell of a lot more stuff from the accident and what I went through, and it's all coming back. Yeah.
I know you spent, was it 33 hours or 36 hours before you actually got operated on after the actual accident?
So, I remember, a lot of it is when I went to the Gaborone Private Hospital, which was probably the worst for me. Experiencing being in that hospital, it wasn't a nice experience. Also because obviously at the time I didn't know what was wrong with me, but we had to go through all the CT scans and sonars, and which wasn't a pleasant experience from my side. The hospital wasn't really well equipped. They didn't have enough bedding. It's just, in that space of not knowing where you are and what's wrong with you. And then just all the hiccups on the way before I got operated on. And then, of course, the pain from when I woke up of small things, like when I had my lungs drained. That's something I won't forget. That was probably the most painful thing I'd ever been through. Yeah. And the doctor did say, we're having your lung drained because they go in between your ribs.
Yeah,
it is.
Fluid in your
lungs. Yeah, so that was exceptionally sore. And just like small things like having a catheter in. I mean, you don't think about those things, but it is so uncomfortable and it's so invasive. And also lying in bed. I was in hospital for 2 weeks, but being in that position where you're moving all the time and you get bed sores and that uncomfortable feeling of having bed sores. I mean, I don't even want to know what it's like for people who have been in bed or in hospital for months. It must be terrible. And small things like that. And then if you think about, I had an allergic reaction to the food that I was being fed intravenously. And so thinking about how nauseous the food that they, because they didn't know, because I was getting so sick, but they didn't know that I was having an allergic reaction to the food, and only after a while. But it's things like that. And like now, after the operation, I had a complication 6 weeks after. My small intestine reburst. But before I'd reburst, I was in hospital for a week, and they were trying to get they were making me drink this fluid stuff to try and make me pass the blockage. And like now, I can't drink any sort of medicine, because it just reminds me of that medicine I had to drink. So anything with an oily substance, I'll just...
The smell.
It's the texture of anything oily, because I had to drink like this oily substance so that they could track the blockage in the small intestine, and then I'll go for x-ray. So anything now with an oily substance that I have to drink, like medicine, talking about it now. and then also the smell of a hospital. So, that for me just, and then a beeping noise. So anything that repetitively beeps or like if there's a noise, it freaks me out. Like in a car, if I'm in a car and something goes doof, doof, doof.
Like the seatbelt.
That, I can't handle that. Or like if you go, because when I was in ICU, everyone was on a life support machine around me, as well as me. So even though I was out, but even beep, it drives me mad. I can't be around. And when I hear it, I have to get away from it if it's somewhere. So small things like that, that just freak me out.
You should write a book or motivational speaking.
It's amazing what you can overcome. And at the same time, our bodies are so fragile, but our minds are so strong.
Yeah.
What you can overcome with a positive, strong mind, it's incredible. And a lot of things is, I think we either, that saying, you either fight or flight. Mm. It's exactly the same. So either you'll shy away from something and never face it, or you'll fight it and overcome it. So it's the strong ones that fight and overcome it and make the best of a bad situation.
Would you ever public speak, or do you public speak and share a story?
I've done a few. I know I need to get better at it. I'm quite shy in front of a crowd. If I'm talking about like my motorbikes and stuff, no problem, but put me on stage in front of a group of people. If I'm talking to guys from the riding community, no problem. But like, put me in front, like I did a talk at Insidience not too long ago, the water polo team. Those guys don't know anything about motorbikes, so I was like, ugh. But I mean, I think it's just something I need to get used to. And just get used to. Also, I just need to, figure out my story in the best way to tell it and how to tell it. But you're not the first person who's told me I need to get into public speaking and motivational talking.
No, I think it's an incredible story. I mean, like I said, I met a lot of people who've overcome some of the most incredible things. The fact that you're actually going to Dakar. And that in itself is a bit, you could just talk about the experience and eulogize about it
for sure
for years, and that could inspire somebody, not certainly not specifically who's an enduro rider or anything like that, but anything they feel seems impossible, or they've gone through this or gone through that, and I think you just never know what you could spark, you know.
For sure.
Yeah. So I think your story is quite incredible. But obviously it's not over yet. You're still gonna
I've still got a whole chapter to write.
Yeah. Plenty more chapters to write. Then what are your bigger goals after you're done racing?
I have no idea. For now, everyone tells me, what's next? You know what? This is my life. I will still do, I will do something within it. Might be something going into motivational speaking. I might write a book. I don't know. I love riding motorbikes, and there is a world of riders out there. So I would like to, I love traveling. Okay. So, you know, I've been asked to do a lot of schools around the world, and I'm still young, so there's still a hell of a lot more racing I want to do worldwide. And you know, a lot of people do one Dakar and they land up doing 10. We'll see.
What's the typical lifespan of a rider?
So with Dakar, there's guys that have done Dakar, I think the oldest guy's like in his 60s or something. But I mean, it's not too long. I mean, I can't really speak, because the current world number one extreme enduro rider is 40, I think it's 42 or 43, and he's doing, except he's beating all the youngsters. So, but he's just like a freak. But I don't know. I think I've got another good 5 years left in me. Also, you know, I've been doing this since I was 8. You know,
and how old are you now?
28.
Still pretty young.
Yeah. So yeah, I think I've got a lot in me, and I just feel like my career has kicked off. You know, even though I've done so much already, I finally feel like I'm reaping the rewards of a lot of hard work over all the years. So I think there's still so much more to do. There's still so much more to achieve. There's still, like you say, still so many more people to inspire, and that's what I want to keep doing.
I saw on YouTube you have quite the mean trophy collection at home or in your garage, which is like, looks like a mad scientist. Which would you say was your favorite event? Not necessarily maybe the race itself, but maybe the location, or maybe the, you know, the country that you visited, or maybe the experience and the people you were with.
So I would say my probably one of my favorite places to ride is in Lesotho. We offer there next week because we've got the Roof of Africa, so that's the event. It's a race that's been going for, I think this is its 52nd year already. One of the longest standing Harney Juros in the world. Lesotho is one of the most beautiful places I've ever ridden. The locals, they are wonderful people. It's some of the craziest riding I've ever ridden. Like, it's really hard. The terrain is really rocky, super technical. The weather can be extreme. I mean, 2 years ago, you know, December, it's supposed to be hot and sunny. We had snow. It was freezing. So you never know what to expect. You can start the race in the morning in snow, and then by midday it can be 35 degrees, and then in the afternoon it could be raining. So it's literally like four seasons in the day. But it's a cool race.
And it's at an incredible altitude as well.
Yeah. We variate from 1,000 meters up to 4,000. It's crazy. So there is so much different stuff there, and it's beautiful, the culture of the country. And, I mean, I've been racing there for, this will be my 7th Roof of Africa. So
you really love it over there.
I love it over there. And everyone says to me, hey, you're doing Roof before Dakar. It's Roof is one of my favorite races. It's something I look forward to every year. So
yeah, what do you know of the country? Is it, I don't know, it's, Dakar was in South America before, and it's been around to quite a few countries. The Saudi Arabia leg, I think, is,
it's the first time.
That should be a different sort of experience. Whole lot more sand, I think.
Yeah.
Than in any other country.
So from the racing perspective, I'm speaking from what's been going around. I mean, I've never done a Dakar, but for the guys, it's, I think they're all looking forward to it, who've been doing Dakars for years, because, I mean, with the race being in South America for the last 10 years, I think it's just the routes have become so overridden, and they've been doing the same routes for many years. Now we're going to a new country, new routes, no one knows what to expect.
Kind of evens the playing field.
It completely evens the playing field. That's exactly what it does. Yeah. It evens the playing fields. No one knows what to expect, so everyone's going there as kind of like a first timer. The country itself, I don't know so much about Saudi Arabia from what I've read. You know, it's not a holiday destination country. I wouldn't choose that as my holiday destination, but I think we're going to be pleasantly surprised.
Yeah.
I'm going there with an open mind, and lots of long baggy clothes. but I think it's going to be pretty cool. I'm always open to new cultures and experiences, those things. So this is going to be, I'm just thinking of this as a big adventure, which is what it's going to be. The Saudis have got big money, and that's why they have Dhaka in their country. And I think they want to prove something to the world. So I think we're in for a good show.
Awesome. I'm sure you'll represent South Africa pretty well.
I hope so.
Right. Okay. Thanks for chatting to me.
Thank you for having me.
I really appreciate it.
It was cool.
Plenty to get through before that Dhaka rally. Obviously, by the time our listeners listen to this, you'll be in the throngs of the race.
Yeah.
But you seem very relaxed right now.
Yeah.
Still about
a month.
A whole month.
Yeah. Nearly, so today's the 28th. I fly on the 31st. So exactly a month to go before we fly out.
Do you get nervous?
Oh, every time, every day closer, I've got a countdown timer on my phone that reminds me every day. And each day that we get closer to it, the mountain gets bigger, the nerves get bigger, but so does the excitement. So there's a lot to look forward to. It's been, like I say, it's been a long journey preparing for this, and I can't believe we're a month away. And before we know it, we're jetting off to Saudi, and I'll probably think back to this, and I'll remember saying this is, it's done, it's over, got my finishers medal. You know, and I can't believe it's all gone so quickly. Yeah, I wish it had slowed down. So it's always like that. But I'm very excited. My preparation's gone exactly the way I wanted it to. I feel like I'm well prepared, and now it's just the waiting game.
Yeah, take it all in and make the best of it.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
That's it for me, Sbu Mjikeliso, and you've been listening to the Sports Live podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. Do also catch us on timeslive.co.za, as well as Sowetan Live, Business Live. We are also on Iono FM, the Apple Podcast Store, or wherever you get your podcasts. It could be Spotify, Stitcher, Castbox, Pocket Cast, wherever. To connect with us, please use the hashtag SportsLive. Share your comments with us at TimesLive or at Sowetan Live on Twitter. A big thank you goes out to the multimedia live team led by Scott Peter Smith and producer Paige Muller, as well as the Tiso Black Star Digital Sports Department headed by Mninawa Mchana Ndoko. Our sound and audio mixer is Innocent Manyike. From us at the Sports Live podcast, it's goodbye for now.